This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined by Bradley Chambers again tonight. We've got three sponsors for the show, the first being Jam Software, a company that provides IT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies such as Macs, iPads, iPhone, and Apple TV in education. More about them at jamsoftware.com. And by Shobi, an iPad app for paperless classrooms. Shobi makes it easy to assign, collect, and review student work and to provide rich feedback with annotations, voice notes, and more. And finally, Aerohive. Aerohive's technology enables organizations of all sizes to use mobility to increase productivity, engage customers, and grow their business. We'll tell you more about all of those as the show goes on. So Bradley, how's it going with you?
Oh, it's a great day. It's a great day. I have a long weekend ahead of me, but we'll make it through.
Okay. Not too bad. Not too shabby.
My role here has changed slightly in the past few weeks.
Okay.
Our technology teacher has had some health issues for a lot of this year, and so she has stepped down. So we are dividing up her responsibilities between myself and our media center specialist. And so I have taken over teaching our fourth and fifth grade students for this year and for the foreseeable future of next year. So that's interesting to me. So I one day I said, "Hey, are you going to be able to do this?" And said, "Let's do it." So I am a few classes in. I have the students for once a week, and so what we're doing, we're changing our focus a little bit in terms of, I'm trying to think of the best way to say this, less teaching technology in terms of like this is how you insert things in PowerPoint versus things like communication skills versus things like digital citizenship. So some of the things I've got planned for next year are, we'll start out, our first unit will be all about digital citizenship, and we'll walk through students about that. And you know, the example that I gave one of our teachers was, I stumbled across the Instagram profile of one of our fourth graders that had a picture of her on it as her profile picture. It was a private account, but she listed her email address in her profile. And those are the kind of things I don't think students are thinking about. I mean, I think most students probably get like, you shouldn't be an idiot online, I hope. And even if they don't, like, you can tell them and they're going to shake their head, they agree. But those are the kind of things I want to talk about, protecting yourself and things like that. Again, we're going to focus heavily on presentation skills, mainly because that's a skill that's going to stay with them throughout middle school and high school and college. You know, the way I explained it to a faculty member here was, teaching them to be experts in PowerPoint 2011 or Keynote 13 or 14 or whatever version we have is great until they get out of school and that's not what they're using, or they, you know, they have a different version next year. So we need to be focusing on how to present well, how to create and craft the theme of your presentation, the kind of the thing I'm harping on them about, because they're doing a presentation right now on every student has a different invention. And so they're having to explain the history of the invention, why it's important, who created it, things like that. And so I've kind of harping them and saying, look, we know the what. You need to tell us the why. And it's not about what your invention is, it's why it matters. And so one of the kids is power lines. And I said, you've got to come in with a good hook. Like, you've got to come in with something, and you've got to really nail it why power lines are important. You can hold up any gadget and say, without power lines, this thing doesn't exist. Or the power lines are what's keeping all of our technology running. Just something, some sort of hook, and ask if they'd heard a good sermon and a bad sermon. They all had, and ask them what the difference was. And so I'm really happy that the kids are responding well. And I had my first aha moment as a teacher as well. I told them, I said, you would be wise to craft out your presentation on paper before you ever sit down at the computer. So you need to sit down and think, you know, what's my theme? What's my why? What am I trying to say? Like, what am I trying to explain? And craft out your slides ahead of time. Because it's not just about putting together the presentation. I said, you can have a great presentation with two slides if you have a great presentation. I said, it's not about the number of slides, or, you know, I'm not talking to them about, you know, not all the text on the screen, not having 90 pieces of clip art on one slide. And one kid in all three of that grade classes came in, and he had his notes sketched out and slide by slide, and he was done with his presentation in 20 minutes. Well, he was done with his PowerPoint in 20 minutes because he already had it written down. And I was so proud because that was like my first aha moment as a teacher where like one kid did what I said you should probably do. It was so great.
These are the percentages you tend to work with as a teacher.
Yeah, it's like if I can reach one kid, it makes it all worth it. No, but it's been rewarding and by gosh, it's exhausting. I teach 5 classes a week and I am exhausted by the end of that. I don't know how teachers do that day in and day out.
I don't know how we do either, but we do. I guess you find that preparation goes a long way. You know, I always feel at this stage of the year, you know, we're sort of, you know, 8 or 9 teaching weeks away from the summer holidays here. And I always feel like at this point in the year, I've kind of got everything up and running and like my classes are kind of on autopilot and I know where everybody's going. I mean, not that I'm necessarily on autopilot as a teacher, but like, it's not like I'm introducing new topics every day. We've done enough now that we can actually work with that information and start to build stuff. I'll give you an example, you know, again, related to presentations. I teach my daughter's class and they're working on, they're using Keynote on iOS. But Keynote on iOS has this amazing feature that almost nobody knows about called interactive hyperlinks, where basically what you can do is you can take any object that you can put on a Keynote slide and you can turn it into a link to another slide. So what we're doing with that is we've looked at virtual museums online and we've looked at some real museums and everybody gets to choose their own topic. But what they've got to do is they've got to imagine that their iPad is like a touchscreen kiosk in a museum and they've got to write the software that will run on that kiosk. So they had to do the analysis of the topic. They had to break the topic down into subtopics and then they had to do a navigation diagram, like as if they were, you know, a web designer or whatever, information architecture stuff. And then they actually get to build it in Keynote and design it and set the buttons and make the navigation work and all that kind of stuff. So it's that's a really cool little project that they're working on. And some of them have really sparked on that and they're building incredibly, you know, detailed and powerful things for their, what you may expect at their age as well. So that's a really, really neat feature in Keynote.
It's like a poor man's programming.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically like HyperCard used to be, except there's no code level programming as such. You know, you're not sitting down and writing, you know, AppleScript or whatever, or HyperTalk as it was back in the day. But you are, you know, you can program in interactivity by setting up different buttons and builds and movements and things to behave in different ways. And there's also a feature where you can set it to be a links-only presentation, which means that the slides you won't be able to move through the slides in the traditional way. You can only move through them by tapping on links. And that way, you know, when I turn that on and if I can't get to certain pages in your navigation, then some links are missing. So some of them are still trying to click into their head. Well, I designed this to have this structure, so where do I put the buttons to make that work? And some of them are still trying to get over that mental hurdle, whereas some of them are over it, and they're like, okay, now I do this, and they're starting to put in little Easter eggs and things like that into their presentation as well, which is really cool. But I would encourage anybody who's looking for a very simple, rapid prototyping application to go ahead and take a look at the interactive hyperlinks feature in Keynote and iOS. It's really super powerful. And you could use that for all kinds of things, you know, web design. You could use it for actual app prototyping as well, you know, just put in UI elements and start to build that as well. So somebody on Twitter today actually said to me that Apple do use that themselves as a way to prototype very early designs for apps on iOS, is to use that exact feature in Keynote.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't think about that. That's actually a great point. Before we move on, let's thank our first sponsor of the night. It is the fine folks at Aerohive. Aerohive makes the cloud managed, not cloud controlled, cloud managed Wi-Fi. It has great technology that enables organizations of all sizes, from retail shops all the way up to major enterprises, to use mobile devices to increase productivity, engage customers, and to grow their businesses. It's deployed in over 13,000 enterprises worldwide. They have a proprietary mobility platform that takes advantage of the cloud and a distributed architecture to deliver unified, intelligent, simplified, and cost-effective networks. I have a great community portal called Hive Nation that you can find about it on their website. It's a place similar to Jamf Nation where you can talk to other Aerohive customers and brainstorm ideas and things like that. It's a great place to go and visit and learn more about their products. But it's at aerohive.com, AeroHive.com. So we thank Aerohive for sponsoring the show this week. So we talked about my teaching, and they call me Mr. Bradley, not Mr. Chambers. Maybe one day I'll be Mr. Chambers, but for now I'm Mr. Bradley. But I think you have had a major migration in your life. So tell us about it.
Yes, I've decided to live as a Photos.app user from now on. I have migrated from an Aperture user to a Photos app user. Obviously, for those of you who haven't seen it, Photos.app is the new, it's basically the iOS Photos app on the Mac, and it's in the public beta of OS 10, 10.10.3, and it, obviously Photos and iCloud Photo Library have been on iOS since iOS 8. So I decided, I'd had OS 10 betas on my Mac for a while. I decided I would go ahead and try the migration, and it's been a very interesting kind of week, I suppose. It's probably just about 6 days since I first turned it on. And just to give you an idea, I think the relevance of this, I think, is that this is probably the number one issue that most people who deal with Mac and iOS stuff in schools will deal with, is all my storage is full with photographs. What am I going to do? And just to give you a kind of picture of where I was, Bradley, with this, I've been shooting digitally since about 2001, pretty much exclusively since the first day I got my first digital camera. I don't think I took another film photograph since that day. As a kind of consequence of that, I had built up an Aperture library of about 31,000 photographs. Now, my habit with Aperture and with digital photography was to shoot a lot. And then in Aperture, you would typically do star ratings as you imported the pictures. And I was in the habit of not really deleting the old ones. So I kind of had more pictures than I actually liked or cared about, but they were all there. And what Photos app can do is it can migrate your library from Aperture into its own file format. And I did that. So I chose to migrate my library. Most of that data, which totaled about nearly 300 gigabytes, lived on an external hard drive that is on my desk. And the internal library was on my MacBook, and that was about 35 gigabytes. So the result of that was that I had about 35 gigabytes on the internal SSD on my MacBook, and all the master files, the raw files from the camera and everything, were out on the disk. And what I did was I migrated that all into Photos and then tried to put it all into iCloud Photo Library. And what happened was that I first realized that because those files were referenced, and that's Aperture's term for the file being somewhere different from the library, because those files were referenced, Photos couldn't put them into iCloud Photo Library. So I had to first do a step that's called consolidation, where basically those masters are copied from their location on the external disk into the Photos library and then synced into iCloud. So I did that over the course of a couple of days, doing it kind of in batches because I had to, I didn't have enough storage space on my Mac to bring in an extra 300 gigabytes of data and still have it work. So by default, what will happen is the Photos library will keep the full resolution of every photograph on your Mac. But because I didn't have enough storage space internally to do that, I had to turn on this feature called optimize storage for your Mac. And what that meant was that I was able to bring in batches of photos. Photos would upload them to iCloud Photo Library, and then it would replace the local copy with an optimized version. Now, this sounds like an incredibly risky thing to do with a beta piece of software on a beta service, but remember that I had copied all of my Aperture masters, that my entire Aperture system still exists as it was, so I wasn't risking anything terribly serious as I was doing that. And then basically I waited and waited and waited. And I had Activity Monitor open on my Mac, and I was just watching the amount of upload bandwidth that was happening from my computer. And it was consistent. You could see clearly, you know, a wee spike every time it finished a photograph, and then it would do another one. And over the course of about 5 days, I managed to upload about 31,000 photos into iCloud Photo Library. So step one, a slow but successful migration of that data up to the cloud. So far, so good. Make sense so far?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, next step is what happened, right? So what happened was that I ended up in a situation, which is where I am now, where my Mac's Photos shows me basically every digital photograph I've ever taken and not deleted, which is great. And I now see I'm almost to the point where all my devices have agreed on what my photo library is. They're slowly coming to a sort of consensus about how many photographs I have. My Mac and my iPhone are the most caught up, in the sense that they're only about 20 photographs different in their counts. My iPad's a little further behind. And iCloud.com doesn't agree with that number either. But what I've heard from people on Twitter is that this step, once you've actually got the bulk of your data up, it can still take some time for all these devices to sync their changes and sync their opinion about what things are. And 48 to 72 hours after you finish uploading the last picture, you should start to see a more consistent view appearing across all these devices. It seems a very slow process, but I think it's beta, it's new, and I'm sure they're measuring the performance of it as well. So I've got 31,788 photos in iCloud, nearly 450 videos. That's taking up 281 gigabytes of iCloud storage. So that number basically matches the size of my Aperture system before I started this migration. So I'm pretty satisfied that all the photos that I had in Aperture are now in the cloud at their native and full resolution, which is awesome. My Mac, the Mac library, the photos library file that's on the internal SSD on my Mac is now taking 115 gigabytes. So it's less than half of the size of the full data set in iCloud. And then on my iPhone, 10.2 gigabytes of data are being used. So it's about, 5%, less than 5% of the full data size is actually present on my phone. Now, what I can see in my phone is if I go to the years view, I can see tiny little thumbnails of all my pictures. So it's as if they're all there on the phone, but they're not actually there. What's there is a tiny little thumbnail. And if I ever, say I go back to like 2004 and tap on a picture, a low resolution preview comes up and then you see a little progress bar in the corner that then spins around and you eventually see the full resolution photo. So the photos are being cached on demand onto the device. But so far, that's a pretty good way. And the app has remained responsive. The Photos app on iOS is responsive, and so is the one on the Mac, even with that amount of data in it. So that's great news as well. Some people have been concerned about that. What I have noticed, though, Bradley, is that other apps on iOS are really struggling with this. And it's apps that implement their own photo picker. So it's apps that use the standard photo picker, like Keynote or Pages or whatever. Those are fine. Bringing up your photo library is fine. It's big, but it's fine. But apps that implement their own photo picker, such as Instagram, you know, when you go into your Instagram and then you choose a picture from your camera roll, that is just fundamentally broken in this world. It is not performing well at all. It's extremely slow to come up, and it gives you a very incoherent view of what's going on in your camera roll. The other one that I've noticed this week is Explain Everything. Explain Everything also implements its own photo picker, and it's really struggling for performance as well in a world where you've got 30,000 pictures in, apparently 30,000 pictures in your photo library. I'm assuming that that's what iOS is reporting to the apps, even though there's not actually 30,000 full pictures resident on the device. So it'll be interesting to see how those apps, you know, make performance enhancements in order to come back up to an acceptable level of performance for larger photo libraries that are undoubtedly coming to iCloud.
Yeah, I took the plunge, reading your tweets, I took the plunge as well and upgraded my Mac to the beta, and then my phone got invited to the public beta as well, so I had put that on there. The interesting thing about the public beta on the phone is it's you install it over the air. You're in the developer program, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm in the iOS for IT program, so I have access to the iOS betas there. But those are just the way they've always been for developers, or download packages that you update through iTunes.
Yeah, which I have a developer account as well. But I was in the public beta for Yosemite, and so they invited me to this. And yeah, it's like you go to a website, some Apple website, you log in with your Apple ID, you install a profile, and then you can literally install the beta over the air. So that was really neat. Well, no, my photo management system is in folders. And so I dumped them all into photos.app at about 9 o'clock one night. And by about, this is about 109 gigabytes of stuff. And by, I would say 8 o'clock the next morning, it was fully uploaded. Of course, I have very, very fast internet. So that's probably a large portion of it. My Mac, while I was doing that, acted like it was going to go into orbit. It was big time. And I was keeping local files. I was not doing the optimization. And so let me ask you this: Are you still keeping a hard backup of photos you take, elsewhere?
Well, I haven't. I'm not doing it elsewhere right now. But what I am doing is, I have a a Mac Mini that lives off-site. And what I've done there is, that's obviously running in my Apple ID as well, I put the Yosemite Public Beta on that, and I turned on, it's basically my Plex server, and I turned on Photos Library onto that machine, and I set that one to store the full resolution. And that machine's also backed up to Backblaze as well. So that's how I'm going to keep a backup of all this stuff as time goes on. For now, I might think of other ways to do it in the future, but that's my plan for just now.
I've been, and I'll write this more up later as I make have more thoughts. And I've been very happy with it so far. Yeah, the upload process was fine. Everything seems to be syncing fine. My concern is a little bit about the UI, and this is difficult for any app. Is, you know, my first digital photo that I have on here is from 2005. That's like when my photo collection basically starts. And so I've basically got 10 years worth of photos. I have 13,000 photos in 10 years. What happens in 20 years from now? Like these user interfaces, how do they make it to where you can find photos that you are interested in recalling? And I don't have the answer to that. And that's the difficult problem for all these solutions is, how do you find stuff? And that's why I like the flashback feature and you know, things like Carousel and EverPix, and then I know TimeHop is really popular for a lot of people. And that's why those are interesting, because it's kind of like, here, you're never going to go back and look at these, so we're going to bring one to you. So that's my number. That's my, I guess, one concern. The second is the pricing is still oh so wrong. I mean, you and I, in like a matter of 2 months, we have four device person. Like, you have four devices from Apple that are like modern, like you've been, you know, jonesing off or leeching off the free upgrades on the software. Like, you are modern devices, and I'm paying $4 a month right now, and you're probably paying 10.
Yeah, I went up to £6.99 a month. I went up to the 500 gigabyte level. I think I can probably slim it down a little bit, but I don't know if I can slim it down much further. I don't think I can get it down below 200 or whatever the next tier is. Because obviously there's other data in there as well, backups and, you know, Keynote files and stuff like that. So I think I'm probably going to stick at that level for a while.
Yeah, that should be free. It should just be. Or it should be unlimited space for $1 a month. These are premium devices, and we have good margins on these devices. Like, they can. Mm-hmm. I think you had a tweet many, many months ago that you wish Tim cared less about the ROI of iCloud. I think he was talking about the ROI of something, and. Yeah. It's like, you know, so who knows? Other than that, like, the only kind of quirk I've had is, like, right now, like, if I'm in the photos tab and I, like, zoom out, mm-hmm. right now, like, 2011 on, I have a ton of just, like, black areas. Mm-hmm. But if I drill down, the pictures show up.
Yeah. So it's I saw that for a while as well. And basically what's happening there is that you've just asked iOS to cache, like, 800 tiny thumbnails. And you'll see that over time, those will start to fill in. I kind of watch that happen over the course. But it doesn't happen until you actually have to see them on the screen. So what I did there was I turned off, there's a setting called Summarize Photos. And what that'll do is, in the years view, it will give you like 10 rows of photographs. Even if you have like 10,000 photographs in that year, it'll only show you a subset. What I did is I turned that off so that I would prompt the device to essentially cache a tiny thumbnail for every photograph that I have. And that's why I'm taking like 10 gigabytes of phone storage, is because I did that. If I turned it off, I wouldn't ever have seen those thumbnails until I actually needed them. But the file record is in there that photo exists. That will fix itself over time, that problem.
It's strange. It just didn't seem – maybe I wasn't paying attention, but like, it seemed to not be that way until like 2 hours ago. Who knows? Anyways, I'm sure that's like a minor technical thing. I just tried to log into iCloud.com for the first time to view the photos. Said it needed to prepare my library. Said it'd take a while. So outside of that, like, pricing is annoying but not a deal breaker. There is no way for my wife and I to share a library, because she has a separate iCloud account. And as you mentioned to me, that'll probably be a feature of family sharing. But that's like a noticeable oddity to me at this point, that like – Apple does a good job about making it where you can use a different store account than iCloud and things like that, but there's no way to use a different like photos in the cloud account than your regular iCloud account. My wife and I use different accounts. Like, she has her own iCloud account, I have mine. We have different data. So that, you know, maybe that'll come. It seems like a natural thing.
You can sort of see some of that stuff coming in you know, like the way that you can go into your purchase tab, and if you're in family sharing, you see other people's purchases in that tab as well under their heading. So you might see something like that in, you know, an additional tab across the top of your photos app that's like photos shared. And then there is a shared thing anyway, but just setting up an automatic, I think there's an automatic photo stream gets created for the family if you go into family sharing. But then that's still a manual step for you to choose to put certain photographs into that. Whereas complete integration of two libraries is not something that they're attempting. I suppose I question whether or not that is something I would want. You know, do I want my wife to see every single thing that I photograph with my phone? Maybe, maybe not. But I think partly because of the kind of privacy rubric that Apple has hung their hat on, but also just a range of different needs, but also just conservatism in the complexity of what we're trying to roll out here, that I would rather that they rolled out individual iCloud photo libraries that actually worked and synced properly, rather than trying to do, you know, two levels of feature and then none of it working. So better to get this one thing right first and then try and expand it after that, I think. Anyway.
Yeah, no, I agree. Just let's make it work and then let's expand the feature set. Yeah, so I'm bullish on it at this point. Mm-hmm. Like I think it's, you know, do I still think EverPixel was better a little, but this is built in, so that's really good.
I think the big thing is going to be, Bradley, that okay, it's $6.99 a month for 500 gigs, but that's worth more than just that raw storage count by itself because of the deep integration with both iOS and the Mac. That has value beyond how much I would have to pay Google or Dropbox to get 500 gigs of storage a month. There's something additional worth paying for, genuinely worth paying for there, than just I've got a raw cloud disk that I can put photos in. I think that's really going to be what justifies the cost to a lot of people.
Well, it was nice because my boss was texting me the other night saying, my wife's phone is full. Like, what do I do? And he has a 16 gig iPhone 6. And I shamed him for buying her that. He said they just didn't have any 64. And so I just said, go in there and turn on iCloud Photos beta and set it to optimize storage. Problem solved. It uploaded and optimized, and she had some storage free. So, I mean, that was nice. But again, how many people are just not going to pay for it? And that's going to be a lot. But I guess you can get 20 gigs for a dollar. So I guess that's better than nothing.
Yeah, I think that low first level, that may be the kind of thing where you might just like turn it on for people and not even tell them and hope they don't notice, because it will solve a problem and then they'll just thank you for having solved the problem. I just wanted to mention as well, Bradley, I did a couple of measurements of the syncing performance between two devices. So I did three different things. The first one I did was I edited a photograph and I waited to see how long it was until that edit showed up in my other device. So what I did was I just took a picture, turned it black and white and hit done on my Mac, and then it took about 8 to 15 seconds for that edit to show up on my phone. But show up it did, and it worked very well. And then photo deletions took about 2 to 3 seconds to sync. So if I deleted a picture on my Mac, it was gone from my phone in a couple of seconds. And then finally, taking a new picture on my phone and having it show up on my Mac, about 15 to 20 seconds. Obviously, that's a big upload step and then an optimization step, so it's a wee bit slower. But in general, sync performance, even though all my libraries aren't quite in sync yet, the sync performance of new data seems to be very good at this point. So yeah, I've been really impressed, and it did a really good job as well of keeping my Mac usable and stable while it was uploading. That was a sort of 6-day operation to get all that data up to the cloud, and it really seemed to work very well. Apart from the fan noise, of course, and a small hit on upstream bandwidth, I was very, very impressed with that.
Before we move on, let's thank our second sponsor of the night. It is the fine folks at Jamp Software. And we're going to talk about more about why you should pick Jamp Software here in a little bit. But if you don't know who Jamp is, they make the Casper suite for iOS and the Mac management. Again, it works with iPads, iPhones, and even Apple TVs along with the Mac. So if you're a school and you need management, you need to check out the Casper suite from Jamf. Now, they have a great app for teachers to put on their iPads called Casper Focus. It allows teachers to quickly gain students' attention, conduct secure exams within an app, select a specific Apple TV. They can choose and distribute iBooks, and they can even initiate AirPlay right from within that app. Learn more about Casper Focus and the Casper suite by going to adaschool.net. And this is episode 126, and we have a special URL to go to Jamf's website. Thanks to Jamf for sponsoring the show this week. So, this has been a long time coming, and that Comet has. And I am as mad about this as I have been anything in a long time. And I'm going to have a link and a in the show notes to a YouTube video from a coach of the Arizona Cardinals. And just FYI, it is not safe for work. He says a few choice words. But he basically says this: they are who we thought they were. And I'm talking about Meraki. So who is Meraki? Meraki was started as a like open source, feel-good type Wi-Fi company. They did this open source firmware, installed on a lot of different APs, and it's, you know, it's meant to, you know, it's a feel-good thing. Like, you know, we're going to take it. It's like the Linux of Wi-Fi. You know, it's in the open. Over time, Meraki evolved into like an actual enterprise Wi-Fi vendor. They added switches, they added security appliances, and they were bought by Cisco a few years for a couple of billion dollars. Well, they a lot of people liked them because they had a free MDM application. And when I mean free, I mean free. Like it cost nothing to deploy, and it was really well supported, had a nice feature set. One of the things we often questioned was, will they, you know, with it being free, will they keep up with, you know, different guidelines for deployments? They did. And during our deployment series, we praised them for that. And we kind of said we were maybe a bit wrong for saying don't use them. We were wrong for backtracking on that because you shouldn't be using them. So what has happened? Well, basically, and then we should have seen this coming because, again, bought by Cisco a few months ago, I think at least two of the founders left. And that is like never a good sign on an acquisition.
Two red flags in a row right there, isn't it? Bought right. By Cisco was number one, founders leaving number two.
Right. So, and we're going to have a link in the show notes to an FAQ on their website called the Systems Manager Transition FAQ, or frequently asked questions. So, let's pause there and let's talk about the reality of an MDM. It is a core competency for any deployment at this point, whether it be iOS, Mac, Chromebooks, really anything you do, you need a way to interact with these devices. Certainly if it's like any sort of, you know, higher scale, you just, you know, if you have a small deployment, maybe you can brute force some stuff. But if you've got a large deployment, like MDM is a core competency. So,
and it's worth saying why it's a core competency, Bradley. The reason being that most of Apple's deployment programs presuppose that you have an MDM in place. If you want to be in device enrollment, if you want to be in volume purchase managed deployment, you got to have your MDM is the only interface to those programs. So there is no way to buy managed licenses and get them to devices without going through an MDM that you own and control.
Yeah, it's just, and you can go back and listen to old shows, and we've talked in depth about MDM. And, like, you know, Jamf sponsors the show, but you and I both pay for it. Like, it's not like that, you know, they don't give us that for free. I mean, I pay a decent amount of money for it, and it's well worth it, in my opinion. So, what is this systems manager transition? This is a crock of crap, is what it is. It is the most atrocious thing I've seen a company do to schools since I've been in education. Because what they did for years is they said, hey, it's free. Sign up. It'll always be free. You know, we have no plans to charge. But I remember reading that on blog posts. It'll always be free. Well, it's no longer free. It is no longer free. So we're going to go to that. I'm going to go to that website. I'm going to go to the Systems Manager Transition website. If I can hit new tab, I'm going to paste that into my address bar in Chrome. So, there are two different types of Systems Manager accounts now. There are kind of like their existing ones and their ones going forward. If you've never signed up for Systems Manager, you no longer have the option of signing up for the free account. Well, maybe you have it for a couple more days. Maybe they didn't see.
It's like 1st of April or something, isn't it?
Yeah, so 1st of April. It's like really soon. But basically, they're moving to a paid model, which is fine. Like, that is fine. I have no issues with, like, saying, all right, no more free lunch. If you're signing up today, it is no longer free. That's fine. Like, I've got no qualms about charging for products. Mm-hmm. But, and they, if you have a free account, you can keep that. But That's basically in maintenance only mode, the free accounts.
Yeah, it's end of life, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like they will get. They said they will get bug fixes for new OSs, but it is not saying anything about new features. And this is ahead of what is rumored to be some major deployment changes from Apple.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, you will be basically. There was an article on 9to5Mac, which said that, I think it was 9to5Mac or maybe. Yeah, I think it
Mac,
was.
I think it's Mac Rumors.
Mac Rumors, okay. Where basically what is being rumored, there's no official announcement on this, but what's being rumored is that the requirement for you to create individual Apple IDs in order to assign volume purchase licenses to individual devices will be taken away, so that you'll be able to assign licenses to devices or to users or both. That's as much as the rumor says right now. But obviously, as far as we can tell, that is going to entail a certain amount or probably a substantial amount of reworking by MDM vendors to be able to do that extra additional part. And this is the key bit that the people at Meraki are not promising to do for those users that are grandfathered into free accounts. They say they'll bug fix for new OSs, but they don't say that they will build new features for new Apple deployment programs for people in that program going forward.
Now, they're offering some sweet deals to upgrade, apparently. I've not read about these sweet deals, but if it's more than free, it's not what they promised. So let me. So what are the benefits of upgrading from the SM standard to Systems Manager? Additional features available with Systems Manager include 24/7 phone support, security features through dynamic security policies like jailbreak detection, disk encryption, antivirus, application whitelist and black disk, automatic selective wipe, integration with your identity management system like Active Directory, integration with Meraki and Cisco hardware that you're already running, and that if I had that with thrown in the trash about this point, because I'm so mad. And here's the great one. Here is the magic bullet point that is screwing every school that deployed it because it was free. All new features as they come out to future-proof your deployment. So that's a big middle finger to every school that deployed it. And yeah, they are what we thought they were.
There you go. That's the other shoe dropping right there. And I know, and as you do, Bradley, I'm sure that there are basically, how close do I want to say this? The biggest deployments of iOS devices I know in the UK in schools are running on Meraki. And these are deployments that go across multiple schools in certain regions, multiple thousands of iPads, all in a free Meraki dashboard. And those people, you know, I mean, what's the price to migrate? There's an individual, it's 100 free devices, but then once you go to 101, you've got to buy 101 licenses. I don't know if they've quoted the price, Bradley, have they?
Again, if it's more than a dollar, it's a ripoff.
Mm. So
it's more than tens of thousands of dollars. Yeah, if it's more than zero to me, because it was promised to be free. It was a loss leader. Mm-hmm. It's a loss leader. Now, I think it's shady. Like, I really think it's shady because the people that deployed this typically are the ones that either have limited budgets mm-hmm. and or limited in-house expertise. Mm-hmm. These are the exact people that are getting screwed the most.
Yeah, because like Meraki was the one that everybody thought was what they wanted, which was cloud-hosted, free, and more than minimally capable MDM solution for schools. And, you know, if you, because at the time, almost every other MDM solution was basically self-hosted. So these are the people who need that kind of solution, and they're basically having the rug pulled. Horrible
it's
situation
blackmail.
To be in.
It's blackmail. That's what it is. It's blackmail. It's saying pay us or move or not get new features. Those are your options. So you should, if you're on Meraki, you need to get off of that platform. I recommend Jamf Software. There are others out there. I like Jamf. Again, disclosure, they sponsor the show. I would migrate this summer. Before anything new comes out with Apple, I would go through the trouble and get off of that platform. Now, and we'll talk about migration paths later. And I think it's important to answer the question, what is the role of free products in the schools now? And I'm going to say outside of Google, because you know many schools are running Google apps. Google has a clear business model of giving things away for free. I don't see them anytime soon discontinuing Google Apps for schools for being free, because Google wants people using their products. That's their business model. With Meraki, obviously, it was selling licenses, selling hardware, And the loss leader clearly was not either becoming too much of a loss leader or it wasn't translating it into hardware sales. So I think you can trust Google to remain free. Outside of that, what do you think? Do you trust anything that's free now?
Well, I mean, we've had this conversation before about free apps. You know, the schools have sometimes built themselves around certain free apps, and then those apps just go away because obviously free apps don't make any money. I think the thing with like Google Apps, for example, is that there's a very clear trend where the value of productivity software like that is heading towards zero, right? iWork is already there. iWork is free with every new device. Google Docs is free, essentially, with a Google account. And Office 365 they're trying to find new and elaborate ways to give it away to schools for free because of this competitive pressure. So I think the challenge you're in with something like Meraki is that you started off with something that was free and now you have to go to something that's not free, whether it be Meraki's paid service or somebody else. But let's say Google Apps went away, for example. What would I do? Well, I'd move to another free Office suite, which would probably be iWork, right? So my overall cost, okay, there's a transition cost, yes, but my overall licensing cost would remain the same at zero, whereas there's no other free MDM that you would want to go to. I mean, Profile Manager, I don't think really counts in this conversation. But, you know, you're going from free to paid. And that's the thing that really hurts because that, you know, if you're a deployment at scale, that is going to blow your budget in a major, major way. I mean, I'm thinking of one deployment I know where it's going to be tens of thousands of pounds. You know, even if they went to a £1 per year per device pricing model, it would be tens of thousands of pounds for them to pay for MDM. And it's more, I mean, it's more than that. Jamf's, we pay more than that per device for Jamf. We pay about £5 per device per year. So that's, you know, you're suddenly talking serious, serious money to get that done. And the problem is that, like we said, you need to have one because otherwise you can't manage your Apple deployment programs properly. And that's a tricky situation to be in.
Before we move on, let's thank our final sponsor of the night, the fine folks at Shobi. Shobi is an iPad app for paperless classrooms, the only kind of classrooms there should be, in my opinion, paperless. With Shobi, teachers can quickly and easily assign, collect, and review student work on their iPads, and then provide rich feedback to students by adding annotations, text notes, and voice notes directly on the documents. Students can show their learning creatively by submitting to Shobi from thousands of compatible iPad apps or by completing assignments with Shobi's built-in tools. Shobi keeps everyone organized with individual student assignment folders, email, and push notifications. Shobi Basic is free to try. A teacher can get up and running with their classroom in just a few minutes. But Shobi Pro is available. It has some great features. And if you buy 5 licenses for your teachers, they'll give you an additional 5 for free. So that's 10 for the price of 5 for a full year. Visit shobi.com/out of school for details. Again, we'll have a link to that in the show notes at outofschool.net. So when we heard this news, you and I started thinking like, well, it's one thing to complain, but we need to have a path. So I reached out to our friends at Jamf and said, like, if someone has Meraki, what do they do? Now, if all you're doing is doing configuration management, if your configuration profiles through Meraki and you don't have your VPP go sending over to it through the managed distribution program, it's going to be a pain. But I know how to do that. Like, you're just going to have to get new configs on the device. You're going to have to run them through Configurator or however way do you get those on there.
You're basically going to have to unenroll and re-enroll those devices.
Right, and that's a pain, but it's like we know how to do that. And again,
and you should be able to keep your configuration profiles, right? You should be able to download a copy of your profiles from Meraki, and then you can upload them into another MDM and then push the same profile settings out through your new MDM channel.
Right. So I want to take you kind of step by step through this. So the first thing, if someone were to move from Meraki to Casper, they would need to remove their VPP managed distribution token from their Meraki server. And we'll list this stuff in the show notes. This is these steps. Second thing, remove their virtual MDM server from Meraki from the Apple VPP managed distribution portal. Okay. And again, remove the token from Meraki, remove the virtual MDM server from the managed distribution portal. They would then add their JSS server as a virtual MDM server in the Apple VPP managed distribution portal. They would download the VPP managed distribution token from the managed distribution portal and then upload that token to JSS. So he says, This is from my SC. He said, in short, you need to sever all ties with Meraki and VPB before you can do anything with JSS. Like, that's a very, very important. Now, here's the thing I didn't understand. Licenses in a managed distribution don't get moved around. They're just pointing back and forth. So Meraki is just polling managed distribution. It's not like those tokens are lost and they're stuck in Meraki like they would be Apple Configurator. And I didn't realize that. Did you know that?
Yeah, the way I understand this is that conceptually, what your NDM system is doing is it has a list of Apple IDs and a list of available licenses, and it, at your command, it will combine, it will assign licenses to Apple IDs. But that binding is not held in your NDM server. That binding is held in iCloud or in the App Store actually. And what your NDM is doing is just taking your instructions, creating a package of requests and sending that to the App Store. And that's why, you know, when you do that, your users can go into the purchase tab and suddenly see a thing in their purchase tab. And that's there. It's not like your NDM is putting new information into the App Store on your users' devices. Your App Store is talking straight to the App Store cloud. But your NDM has occasioned there to be a new app assignment in that cloud from your instructions. So basically what your Apple is doing is they're using the NDM server as a user interface for you to create those assignment pairs and then send them to the App Store from there. Does that make sense? So the pairing actually, the pairing of licenses to Apple IDs lives in the App Store cloud, not on your NDM server. So you'll have to obviously recreate those assignments in a new workflow. That's the tricky and timely bit, is to recreate that assignment. But in principle, I think there should, I'm doing this as a thought experiment, I haven't tested it, but I think there should be no disruption to the license assignations on the devices for your users. They should just sail on as normal. And as long as you don't revoke those licenses in the App Store, then you should be good to go. That's my sense of doing this.
And if I was like Jamf or AirWatch or somebody, I would go after these customers with, like, I would offer aggressive, you know, year one pricing to get these folks moved, help them out, get so they can rebudget for this next year. Because
and support to make that transition. Because are the people who are going to need huge support, right? These people are not going to be people like you and I who have got extensive experience of dealing with NDM. These are people who basically signed up for the thing they knew was free and then just started to enroll devices one by one. Those people are going to need a lot of help to get through this.
So, yeah, that's my rant. That's probably the maddest I've ever been on this show, I would say. Because I am as mad about this as I've been about anything in a while.
I can't think of another thing that has been so widely adopted and then has been so blatantly sort of bait and switched since we've been working on the show, at least. You know, that was the thing that people, and we were skeptical about it from years back, because we thought, well, we looked at things like managed distribution coming along. Well, Meraki is not going to make that transition. They made that transition. That gave people a lot of confidence, you know, even after we said, be careful about this. And then we saw them come into the iOS 7 world in a very timely manner. In fact, at least as fast as other NDM providers. And now this is the thing, this is the other shoe dropping now, 2 years after we were sort of first skeptical about it. And I think it's a dreadful shame for people who have heavily invested in this platform. What they're hoping for clearly is that it will be easier for these people just to pay them the money than to go through the pain of trying to transition. And I think if it was me, if I had a really large-scale deployment on Meraki, I would probably be considering paying them whatever they want until my next deployment. And then at my next refresh, I would look at changing my MDM server again. I understand your point, Bradley, about getting off as soon as possible. But I think from even just a practical point of view, if you are a huge deployment, how do you even get all those devices back to get them enrolled again? Or how do you get all the users to enroll as well? Because you have to do a pretty sharp cut over there between one and another. And that's going to be a quite challenging thing to do. So it might be the kind of thing that in this come the summer, you want to think about doing a reboot of your deployment into some kind of new MDM server at that point.
Yeah, that's probably more wise. I'm just being spiteful.
Yeah, well, I think it's now is the time to begin your planning for that, no question about it, and execute that plan probably as soon as is practically possible. But quite often, you know, giving people money to make problems go away is something that we have to do from time to time.
Okay, in rent.
All well, right. I mean, it's good information. I think it's important for people to know that there is a way out of this, that you're not just stuck giving Meraki money. It would be a good opportunity to evaluate other solutions. Jamf is a good option. I know other schools that are very successful with Lightspeed as well, particularly schools that use Lightspeed Web Filtering and Lightspeed MDM. Having that integrated package is very useful. And of course, there's AirWatch and MobileIron and various others as well. You're not short of options, I think, is what I really want to say about that. There's plenty of MDM providers out there, and it's just which one suits your needs the best.
So we'll see how this rolls out, especially as maybe who knows, maybe when the new deployment stuff, maybe they do grandfather people in if there's enough outcry. But we're not holding my breath.
It's Cisco, they don't give nothing for free. Yeah. Okay, so shall we wrap it up there? We're going to have another couple of interview shows coming up. I hope people are enjoying these interview shows. We're trying to schedule them. I'm going to talk to one of my pals from India next week. And Bradley, you've got another interview lined up as well. So we're trying to do different things. And we'd appreciate your feedback as in whether you think these are good shows to kind of mix in. We're trying to do it just to get to give a little variety to the show, to give ourselves a little break from necessarily doing the show paired up every single week in life. But I think it's the feedback's been good so far, and I think we're going to keep doing it unless people tell us to stop.
Yeah, I think it's good to get different perspectives, and it helps us all grow. I mean, you and I have been talking every week largely, or 47 weeks for the past nearly 3 years at this point, mm-hmm. So it's always good to get others' opinions as well.
Most definitely. Yeah. Okay, let's leave it there, Bradley. I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter and spears.org on the web.
I am Bradley Chambers on Twitter and chambersdaily.com on the web.
Okay, we'll see you everybody next week.
Have a good week.